Hey everyone, you're listening to the Working Triathlete Podcast. This podcast is devoted to helping you find maximum performance with deliberate efficiency. Hey Conrad, how's it going?
It's going well. We had a good weekend. Working Triathlete had a great weekend of racing. I know that you did. You're up in Benton Harbor for 70.3 Ohio, and we had an amazing showing there.
Sandusky, Ohio.
Oh, Sandusky. Yeah. Benton Harbor is
that's
Michigan.
Steelhead. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. But Sandusky is even more of an amazing location, right?
Well, I'd probably choose Benton Harbor over Sandusky. I think like Michigan does trump Lake Erie, but it was still a great location.
Yes, but you know, had great results up there, which we will discuss. And then I was in Louisville for Tri Louisville with a few athletes, and you know, Working Triathlete, we did quite well there. We won the so Jackson, he's a Working Triathlete. He won the Olympic distance race there. Anthony Didion, he won the sprint race. Brian Sa won the duathlon. So it was a successful outing there, but we should talk about 70.3 Ohio first, because Caroline Kaplan, she won the whole thing.
She did. We talked about it before the race, and I knew she was prepared to do incredibly well. The analysis we had was she was going to break 4:35, and her execution was amazing on race day. And it was just so cool. Like the running course of Ohio, and I'll talk a little bit more about the swim and the bike, but you get to see everyone twice. It's an out and back, so you can know exactly where everyone is. But seeing her in the lead was, it gave me goosebumps on the run course. It was pretty cool seeing my athlete out there crushing it with the lead bike, and truly an awesome performance. And again, the execution was phenomenal. Like she had a great swim. Her and I swam together almost the entire time. I could see her next to me as we made the last turn going east into the sun, which was difficult to see. But and then she crushed the bike. I mean, the swim was a little slow. I think, I don't know if it was long, if there was a current or what, but you know, I would say it was par, you know, two and a half minutes slower than what people generally swim. So that was pretty common for most people. The bike was flat and fast. We had a headwind for, you know, the first 28 to 30 miles. And then on the way back, we had a nice tailwind, especially the last 10 miles. So it was a fast bike course, super flat, and, you know, just a couple of rollers at the back end of it. She biked like a 225, and then got off the bike and just ran her way to victory in a 131. And the run, I think she's a strong runner. But I can't wait to see what she runs when she's being challenged, because it's only going to be faster after that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's probably worthwhile. So she improved a lot. I think it's worthwhile kind of talking about what separates athletes and enables athletes to continue to progress or reach a high level compared to others. And, you know, we see this in all of the elite athletes we work with. Like, what do they do differently that separates them from, say, an average age grouper? And I think that the number one is consistency. So, you know, I mean, Caroline, she has been in Nashville training for a few months, and number one is showing up every day and doing the work, and she does it. A great job nailing workouts as one needs to do, but hitting the target zones, that's number one. So consistency and sticking to the plan is essential. And then number two is the recovery piece. And that involves dialing in nutrition. It involves sleeping as much as you can. It involves hydrating well, and sleeping. I know I said sleeping, but I'm going to say it probably three more times.
Yes.
Because the best athletes, they need to, you need to relax, you need to recover. And I would say that that's probably the number one factor that separates sort of maybe top age groupers from athletes who are able to make the leap into the pro ranks. Cause everybody, a lot of athletes are willing to train a lot. They're willing to put in the work, but a lot of athletes are not willing to, you know, eat well. They're not willing to say, I'm not going out, or I'm not having this beer, or I'm not having this glass of wine because I need to sleep well, because I need to nail my training tomorrow. So, you know, just, I just wanted to highlight the importance of just consistency and recovery, because that's what it all comes down to. And, but yeah, big kudos and congratulations to her winning her first 70.3 race. Obviously she's done 70.3s, but this is the first victory.
Yep. First victory. And a lot of other great performances out there. I know we had a couple of girls break five for the first time, Helena and Victoria. They broke five. We had a couple other guys break. Cameron broke five, you know, and that was his target. But overall, a great day. And, you know, I spent most of the run chasing Mitch down, and he, you know, he had a huge PR as well. I mean, I think he led the race almost for a long time, and he crushed that bike course out there. And it was great seeing him out there as well. And we just kept each other motivated and pushed hard to the finish line.
Yeah, it's we definitely need to highlight Mitch and Caroline together, because they're actually a couple. So, you know, they moved to Nashville. They're on our elite squad, and so they obviously live together and train together and progressed extremely well. So, you know, he improved. I mean, he PR'd by 10 minutes, went 4:02, and executed well and put down a pretty, pretty courageous bike split. And I mean, he had the fastest bike split by a fair amount. He rode 2:06, and it, you know, doing that was a necessary step in his development, as, you know, his aspirations of going professional. And in races, you know, he's still very new at triathlon. And when you're new, sometimes you need to roll the dice a bit and push your limits. And, you know, he put out stout power. I would say at the very upper end, or maybe a little bit above the target range, but still within certainly the ballpark of what he was capable of. And it, you know, it paid off with a very good bike split. And then on the run, you know, he ran well, didn't fade too badly in the second half, but slowed down a hair. And but it was good and productive for him to push the limits on the bike a little bit and treat every race as a stepping stone. And you know, understand it's all about balance in a 70.3, you know, mm-hmm. how much power can you put out and still run well? You know, somebody like him, he probably could have given up 2 minutes on the bike and potentially run, you know, 3 or 4 minutes faster. But when you have aspirations of going pro, I think it's okay to push the limits in a way where you're aware of what's happening and okay with potentially giving up a little bit of time if you overdo it a bit. But you know, you need to, with somebody like Mitch, I mean, every month, you know, power numbers are improving, you know, mm-hmm. run pace is improving. So it's every race is a test. It goes back to, I think it was Sebastian Kienle, like, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, talking about like a decision that occurs on the bike, you know, in certain races, especially at Kona, where maybe there's a move and somebody's making a move. And you know that if you go with that person, you know, you might have a 20% chance of winning. And if you go with that person and you blow up, you know, maybe you don't even make the podium, but you know that if you play it safe and you go easy, you can kind of protect, you know, a third place finish or a fourth place finish. But the decision is, okay, do I go for the win or do I just, am I careful and smart and I just want a payday or something? And it depends on the race. I think it depends on goals. It depends what you want. I know certain pros who make a living, sometimes they have to, they need a paycheck. So they might start a race thinking, okay, you know, I'm just need to get to the finish line and I need to make my whatever $3,000 for finishing, you know, third or fourth rather than, you know, necessarily going for the win. But I think that's pretty rare. I think most athletes toe the line wanting to win.
I think experience matters, but you know, I think the data of what we see in training can give us a pretty big picture of what someone's capable of, but you're right. Like sometimes you have to roll the dice and see what happens, because while you're never going to like outperform what your fitness is, sometimes there is going to be a breakthrough where you just are able to move a lot faster than you expected and everything clicks well. And yeah, when you're doing it for a living, you sometimes have to roll the dice. And if you're just trying to improve, you got to see what your body's capable of and test the limits and just mentally get tougher and physically find out where the limit is.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because, you know, we do testing with athletes frequently, and we've been doing a lot of inside testing recently, and we've seen kind of transformations from athletes just because, you know, they do a test and they realize, oh, I'm actually this fit. Like, oh, I didn't realize I was this fit, but it's almost like they all of a sudden give themselves permission to take the next step. And that's where we see breakthroughs. It's like athletes, they might view themselves as somebody who, you know, I can put out 300 watts during an Olympic distance race. And it's like, well, this is where your anaerobic threshold is. Like, you should actually be able to put out, you know, 315, 320, and then you train to that. And then athletes, you know, their confidence builds, and they have the belief that they can throw down, you know, a certain performance on race day, and they go out and do that. You know, I'm not saying that, again, you can't fake fitness. Fitness is fitness. But, you know, there's a big mental piece of it. We know this psychobiological model of training, like Alex Hutchinson talks about in Endure, his book Endure, which is behind me right now. But it's exciting to see breakthroughs and to see athletes take the next steps and crush races. So yeah, Ohio was an overwhelming success, pretty much without exception. Everybody performed very well. And like I mentioned, we had a number of athletes go to Louisville. So Team Magic puts on a really cool race in Louisville called Try Louisville. And we had a crew go there, travel up from Nashville. And like I said, Jackson won the Olympic distance race by minutes. Anthony won the sprint, and Andy Van Landingham, he was second in the sprint. And then we had you know, Brian, they have a duathlon, they have an aqua bike, they have a bunch of different multi-sport events. And Brian, I think that was his first race that he ever won. He won the duathlon and had a really, really good performance there. But you know, I think it's interesting because when we think about how, you know, certain weekends, everything comes together for everybody. I mean, we had dozens of athletes compete, and I can't think of one instance of anybody having, you know, a race where they didn't necessarily perform up to what their sort of fitness would have allowed or would have indicated. And it's interesting because 2 or 3 weeks ago, it seemed like there were many athletes who were struggling.
Yeah.
And they were struggling because of a couple of things. So the heat, number one, a heat wave that is just raging across the world, I guess, but especially the US. It's tough. You know, a lot of athletes, if it's 90 degrees and humid and you're doing a track session, like, you need to adjust pace expectations. So, you know, sent out a weekly nugget email last week to the team just about, you know, how do we think about the heat? You know, your pacing went for outdoor riding and running, like, you're arguably performing worse now than 2 months ago, but that's not because you're less fit. It's because of the heat. You know, in 90 degree temps with humidity, if you're doing a 5K tempo run, say, you need to adjust your pace by about 20 seconds per mile. So that's a good, like, tangible adjustment that sort of allows an athlete to understand, like the difference. You will perform worse in the heat, and this is what the adjustments should be. And once athletes, I think, realize that, they're like, oh, okay, maybe I'm fitter than I think. And then, so that plus a taper just helped athletes break through. I mean, we had so many PRs this past weekend, like, so many of us had PRs, and that was due to, in no small part, to a good taper too. So, you know, before the taper, again, many athletes were worried, because worried about their fitness, essentially, or they were feeling, you know, maybe tired from training, or, and, you know, it's hot out. It's just tough to wake up every day and get out and just feel like you're sweating all the time, and you just feel fatigued all the time. But, you know, this is good evidence, you know, just the incredible performances from this past weekend, that, you know, you need to trust the process, have faith that, you know, you're doing what you need to do to maximize performance on race day. But, you know, seeing this inspired us to want to talk about tapering today in this podcast. So, you know, what is a taper? So a taper is basically the period going into a race where you kind of tweak training to unload fatigue in order to maximize performance on race day. I mean, everybody knows what a taper is. You know, you're able to train a little bit less. You start feeling good throughout a taper, and then it'll let you feel bouncy, maybe as the race approaches, a little more springy, and then you're able to crush it on race day. But, you know, let's just talk about some principles of a good taper. So how do you think about a taper? Like, what do you think, you know, a good duration is, maybe, for a typical athlete?
Yeah, generally most athletes, from, you know, a lot of studies in the past have shown like 8 to 14 days, but I didn't tend to stick between 7 to 10 days for most athletes. And, you know, that's going to be a period where we really just reduce the volume. You know, we want to maintain some intensity in there, that way the athlete's sharp, but really we're peeling back the volume, you know, 40 to 60%. That way we're unloading that fatigue and they're going into the race with proper form.
Yeah. That is, I think that's a good time range. The studies show that, you know, tapers, they certainly need to be less than 21 days. So fewer than 21 days. The science sort of shows in that, you know, that 8 to 14 day range is the sweet spot. And, you know, what happens is, you know, you want to kind of, right before the taper, training load typically is highest. So, you know, there's evidence that this pre-taper overload plus the taper, that has a very significant effect on your race performance and your ability to go faster over a set distance, or even your time to exhaustion also improves. And, you know, sometimes athletes wonder, you know, what's going on? Like, why does a taper work? And you know, part of it involves just unloading fatigue. So over time, you know, the body kind of wears down with training. So we want to, you know, overload with training and then recover. And when you're training, I mean, you're wearing your body down, you're tearing up the muscles and you're sweating a lot. So your plasma volume is decreasing and your body is constantly trying to heal itself. And that's why throughout training, you know, we have recovery days, we have recovery weeks, we have transition periods, depending on what sort of time frame we're talking about, because the body does need to reset. And a good taper, you know, it will foster improvements in, you know, blood plasma volume. So the volume of your blood will increase. So with each, you know, beat of your heart, your body can send more blood to the working muscles. Enzyme activity improves throughout a taper. So your body is just better at, you know, taking oxygen, you know, turning it into energy. And it's also just the case that, you know, you can see a sort of an upcharge in your central nervous system. Athletes, they report feeling stronger, sharper, and fitter as the race approaches. That sort of heavy leg feeling can go away. And this typically can result in an improvement in performance of, you know, like low single digits, say 3-4% is not uncommon. And that's substantial. Obviously it depends on the athlete, and certainly the way that his taper should be structured depends on the athlete for sure. And the only way to figure out the ideal way to taper is to experiment a bit, but there are certain principles that, you know, one can adhere to in order to, you know, sort of ensure that a taper will help. And like you mentioned, sort of you like 8 to 10 days. You know, I think that's a good rule of thumb. You know, you kind of extend it out, I think, to, you know, 10 to 14 days. Once you're above 14 days, I think that you run into a little bit of a risk going flat. And if we think about, like, you know, 30 years ago, you know, I know marathoners, it was really common for them to taper for, you know, 3 full weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And we know now that that's certainly longer than is needed or is ideal for most athletes in most situations. But I mean, if somebody is training huge volume and they're a bit burnt out, maybe they overreached in training, they actually might benefit from a longer taper of up to 3 weeks. But I think they're the exception. And, you know, again, if one is really burnt out, I think, you know, they can look at doing that. But the ideal taper duration, I would say 7 to 14 days is how to think about it. And then what are some principles that govern the actual taper itself? Like, you know, we think about frequency or intensity.
Yeah, definitely want to maintain frequency and intensity there. Yeah. But like I said before, it's just really reducing the volume, you know, because if you're peeling back the intensity too, you could risk going flat going into the race, because you want to make sure you're race specific going into that race as well. And if you're just doing easy volume, you might go a little flat and just not be sharp on race day.
Exactly. You know, maintaining that frequency is important. You know, some athletes might benefit from having maybe an extra rest day during the taper, but I typically like to avoid that because we want to keep the rhythm of training going. We want to keep everything activated. And there's evidence that, you know, the best way to structure the taper, and, you know, there's data to back this up, is to maintain frequency, but lower the overall duration, keep intensity up. So maybe keep a similar intensity factor throughout the week. But we want to shorten the duration of the intervals. So we're shortening the duration of each session and we're shortening the duration of the intervals. And, you know, typically, again, varies person to person, but if we're going to look at it in a fairly simple way, you know, 2 weeks out, you can reduce TSS by 20%. And then, you know, the next week you can reduce it by another 20 or 30%. So that's going to lead to a reduction of you know, 40 to 60%, like you said, in overall load. But we're not lowering necessarily the intensity factor. So, you know, if somebody's doing, you know, 2x20 minutes for the key intensity bike, you know, 2 weeks out, we might reduce that to, you know, 2x15 or something similar. And then the next week, we're reducing it even more. You know, you could shorten the intervals or, you know, do more of them, but shorten them. So there are different ways to lower the load, but the idea is we want to get the body ready to race. And part of that is unloading fatigue. So giving the body additional time to recover and replenish and just everything and repair itself. But there are different rules, I think, for different athletes, like principles that are universal. And let's talk about just a couple more of those before going into maybe individual cases of athletes doing unique tapers. But so when we think about, so everybody should reduce volume relative to, you know, obviously peak volume, but, you know, even so high volume athletes, they're going to reduce their training load, just overall training load more simply because they're training at a higher volume, but maybe the percentage is similar. But, you know, when we think about lower volume athletes, we do want to be careful with reducing the volume too much, because if somebody's training like 6 hours a week, there's only so much reduction that you can do or should do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if somebody's training 20 hours a week, we might see a reduction of, you know, if we reduce it 25%, that's 15 hours. So that's reducing it by 5 hours, but obviously you can't reduce somebody who's training 6 hours. You can't reduce their plan by 5 hours, but, you know, there still should be, if those 6 hours, if that's extremely fatiguing to an athlete, then there still should be a reduction in overall load. So maybe you reduce it by an hour, or you just reduce, you know, the duration of the intervals there, and that's productive. But we want to be careful with lowering the load across the board, especially as it relates to swimming. So the swim is interesting to talk about, because the thing is, triathletes, they just, most of them don't swim that much.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you're swimming 3 times a week, 2 to 2.5K each session, there's actually no need to reduce that at all, you know, during the taper. I think it's counterproductive, actually, because you sort of lose that feel for the water. So with lower volume athletes, I like to keep the swim volume up, sometimes even increase it a little bit race week. But certainly reduce the overall load of the cycling and the run sessions. But, you know, for athletes training, you know, swimming 20 to 30K a week, yeah, we'll reduce the load there, certainly a bit in the last week. But as a rule, you know, we reduce the load of the swim, you know, less than the load of the bike and the run. And of those, I would say we probably reduce the load of the run the most, because that's the most corrosive to the mm-hmm. body. But we also want to be careful, because certain athletes, especially high volume athletes, if you reduce their volume too much, they actually might respond negatively to that. And, you know, if they're used to doing, you know, 25 hours a week and riding their bike 10 hours a week, you know, all of a sudden slashing it down to 5 hours 2 weeks out and 3 hours during race week, that might lead to them just simply not feeling good, because their body just doesn't know what's going on. And keep, again, maintaining that rhythm of training is important. You don't want to shock the system too much in the taper. So for higher volume athletes, you know, we still might be training 2 hours a day the week of the taper, and that's fine. Again, frequency across disciplines is essential. But, you know, for those athletes, it's still a reduction, and their bodies, it will unload fatigue, and they'll be ready to go on race day. So that's, it's important to consider that everybody, you know, needs to taper differently. And I know that it also depends on the race. I know that you like to race pretty frequently, and I know that if you tapered going into every race, you would basically always be tapering and recovering from races.
Right.
So, you know, how do you approach, you know, working with an athlete who, say, is training and, you know, say they're doing multiple races in a 2-month period?
For sure. Yeah. So I think it's first identifying what's the most important race, and then also identifying, like, what's the duration of these races? You know, if they're doing a sprint or a 5K or something shorter, and it falls into the training plan, they might not even taper at all. Maybe the day or two before, there's less intensity. That way they can perform well at that race, but we may not be peeling back volume at all. Like you mentioned, like I generally race frequently, and when you're racing frequently, you just can't, you'll lose fitness over time if you continue to pull back volume if it's multiple races throughout a couple months. But you want to make sure you're identifying the race that's most important. That way you can appropriately taper for that event. But again, like the duration of the event too is going to matter quite a bit. So I think for most of us, or us as coaches, the athletes that are going to have like their A races, it's probably going to be a long course event. Or if it's, you know, nationals, you know, in 2 weeks, that's an Olympic distance and sprint distance. If they're doing a race that was 2 weeks out, they're probably not going to be tapering going into that race. And then after the race, they're preparing for that taper going into nationals.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is why we have A races, B races, C races, and, you know, the CB races. Maybe you just go easy a couple of days before those, and you go into those with measured expectations. You know, every race should not involve this 2-week taper, because you're just losing fitness at that point. But yeah, I mean, those are good points. And, you know, there are other athletes I work with, and we just know that they don't respond well to this sort of traditional taper we're talking about. They benefit from keeping the volume up a little bit. And, you know, this is certainly the case with, I think, long course athletes, Ironman athletes, certain ones. We still keep the volume fairly high. And, you know, certainly we unload fatigue into this, going into this last, as the race approaches. But, you know, for some athletes, we kind of maintain the volume 2 weeks out, but then we'll do more of an aggressive taper as the race approaches. So, you know, 2 weeks out, maybe we still are doing a 4-hour ride. We're still doing a decent amount of intensity, you know, traditional intensities, accruing, say, 40 minutes of sweet spot work for a key intensity session, or maintaining swim and run volume. But then the week of the race, you know, we'll even continue going hard through Tuesday, but then Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, we dramatically reduce the load. Certain athletes, they race better that way. And it isn't necessarily clear why, but consistently, you can test all of these. You just, in different ways, just macrocycle to macrocycle, you know, you can kind of manipulate the tape out what works best. But that's sort of a unique way to do it. I think that certainly if we had to pick one way to do it, I would say 2-week taper, reduce 20% 2 weeks out, 20% the next week. Again, so you have to experiment. And there are other considerations, I think, even separately from training. And, you know, when one is tapering, it, as we mentioned, we're unloading physical fatigue and letting the body kind of repair itself and heal. But we're also allowing, honestly, the brain and the mind to reset also. And one recommendation, you know, I always give to athletes is we want to be lazy during taper week. So oftentimes we reduce training load and we have all of this energy and we want to channel it somewhere. And certainly it's fine to pay more attention to other life responsibilities apart from training during taper week, but we don't want to take on like all of this additional cognitive load or start doing physical labor. Like, it's not the time to, you know, landscape your yard by working 8 hours in the heat, you know, pulling logs and, you know, stumps and hand tilling your garden or something. We want to be lazy physically as well as mentally. So try to minimize stress, minimize cognitive load, just give yourself permission to let the body heal. It can be productive to take an extra day off of work before the race, or, you know, just try to do these stressful tasks maybe earlier in the week or a few days ahead of the race rather than, you know, a few days leading into the race. That way you toe the line in a more refreshed and a positive state of mind. And that it, we know that, you know, life stress and mental, just using your brain and having a high cognitive load, it does impact performance. You know, I talked about the book Endure earlier in this podcast, but there have been studies where, you know, athletes, they do these tasks that involve a high cognitive load, like reciting numbers backwards. So if I say a phone number, like, I'm not going to say a phone number because somebody might call that number, but yeah, there's a number and then they ask you to recite the number back and you do that for like an hour. And then you do a test, you know, on the bike or something. Athletes who do something that is mentally stressing before, their performance will decrease. And the same goes for the race. Like, if you can somehow figure out how to just make the few days going into a race low stress as possible, that's going to help. So consider that.
Yeah. I think it's also worth mentioning too, some people might experience like phantom pains or a little bit of unpreparedness as they enter the taper too. And I think this is just the mind preparing itself for the task at hand at the end of the week, the race. And I think as people continue to race frequently and they build experience, and you know this is how your body's responding and how your mind's responding, it'll build confidence because you're prepared for that feeling. Because without a doubt, there's always a couple of athletes as they lead into a race, they feel like their fitness is just is non-existent at that point. They feel like they can't hit certain paces. But I believe for a lot of these athletes, it's their body and mind preparing for the race at the end of the week.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it. And I think a big chunk of it is your body is not producing as much endorphins as it was before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, endorphins are painkillers and your body stops releasing them if you're not working out. So, I mean, part of it is just like you're sort of feeling where you are at baseline and even a little bit worse, because we know that, I mean, anything that, you know, produces, I think, dopamine or endorphins, when you stop that, the body sort of reverts back to baseline or even a little bit below for a period and then goes back up. So, if you're not getting that boost, that endorphin boost each day, you might feel those niggles with a little bit more clarity, and taper blues is certainly a thing.
Mm-hmm.
You might start feeling a little bit depressed, you know, at the beginning of a taper, especially, and, you know, that just because, you know, there are fewer good sort of natural painkillers and endorphins and feel good neurotransmitters circulating because you're not exercising. So consider that, know that that's normal, and know that your body is not all of a sudden breaking down. It's just, you're not tired all the time. You're probably hyper aware of how you're feeling. You're thinking about the race. You're thinking about how you are physically and mentally, you know, in relation to the race. Like, it's, you're at a very almost vulnerable state. So relax. Give it time. distract yourself and have faith in the process. Enjoy the lower load, the lower volume, spend more time with friends and family. You know, don't do destructive things like drinking alcohol or eating unhealthily. You know, with the lower load, we need to adjust what we're eating a little bit. You know, it's okay. You need to keep eating well, and you need to make sure that your body has the fuel it needs to repair itself and to continue executing the work. 2 weeks before the race is not the time to try to lose an extra, you know, pound or two for the race. That's not a good thing. Keep eating well, but don't gorge yourself. You don't want to put on 5 pounds in the mm-hmm. last 2 weeks before the race. So you probably will need to adjust your calories down a little bit, but, you know, don't go too wild there. And certainly when it comes to carbo loading, you know, two or three days going into the race, it's reasonable to increase the percentage of your calories that come from carbohydrates, but you know, you don't need to be carbo loading for 2 weeks. And as the race approaches, certainly increase the percentage that comes from there, but you know, there's no reason to continue doing that, you know, for 2 weeks before.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, so, you know, all of these things are good to keep in mind. You might feel worse during a taper, especially early on, but have faith that it will improve, and the restraint will pay off with, again, I would say, you know, 3 to 4% improvement is pretty typical with after nailing a good taper. So yeah. So aim to nail your next taper. And, you know, if you're feeling, certainly if you're not doing well in this heat, it's okay. You know, so don't worry about it. Don't, you know, when, as your race approaches and the taper kicks off, you're going to see a bump in fitness and you're going to feel better. So don't sweat it. If you don't feel as fit as you normally do, because you're working out in the heat, and, you know, also if you're approaching an A race, you might be feeling a little bit more fatigue than usual. So when you hit the taper, you know, you might feel like $1 million in just a week or so. But, you know, I don't want to say that and not recognize that overtraining is certainly it's a real thing. And you do not want to overtrain either. But, you know, we want to differentiate sort of feeling heavy or flat because of heat and, you know, just the normal preload training before a taper. Like, we want to differentiate between that and actual sort of long-term overtraining syndrome. But, you know, just know that it is important to frame where you are relative to conditions, relative to the weather, and weather relative to sort of where you are in your training cycle. But you know, it's that time of year where we're sort of in the middle of the summer and athletes are, many of them are ramping back up and targeting fall races, or they're just kind of finishing their sort of early season. We're not really early season anymore, but maybe they're A races for the year and they're in a transition time. I know that we are just a couple weeks out or less from USAT Nationals in Milwaukee. And we are very excited about that. I know we have a good crew, big crew going there. So that'll be a blast. And I know you and I are going to coach. So
oh, yeah.
It'll be
hands
fun,
on deck.
Fun weekend. All hands on deck. Yeah. You'll see me running up and down the course, screaming like a maniac. I'm trying to make it so that athletes crush it and are ready to push that last 5K, because that's a goal.
Yeah.
Negative split the run, last mile your fastest. That's a good way to do it.
It's going to be a good weekend in Milwaukee. You know, they paired age group nationals with youth nationals, and they've also added the PTO event as well. So it's going to be a full weekend of racing, and we have a lot of athletes going, and we're expecting to see some outstanding performances. But Yeah, I can't wait to see you in 2 weeks and everyone else out there.
Heck yeah, it's going to be fun. And then the weekend after Nationals, we're having a little camp in Nashville for working triathletes, and that's going to be another fun weekend. So two big weekends in a row for the team. But it's going to be a good way to kind of push through midsummer and set everybody up for success. I know that many athletes are now starting to think about fall long course races, and a huge chunk of athletes are targeting races in late September, early October. You know, North Carolina is a big target race for us. And then many athletes are doing Augusta, and, you know, solid number doing Memphis. So it's going to be a good rest of the year. And, you know, so far for the team, you know, we're all really happy and excited with how things have gone, and looking forward to the rest of it. And I know that I've been talking with Alex, my wife, about Clash Daytona. And that's going to be a big target race for us. And we're discussing how the heck we're going to get there with a baby and a golden retriever. It's there are a lot of moving parts there, but you know, that's also on our radar finally. But man, this year is flying by.
I know, it's pretty wild. It's funny you mentioned Clash Daytona, because Hannah thought I was racing North Carolina, which I am not, because it'll be a couple weeks after our second baby's due. But I was ready to retire from long course after Ohio, but I was sniffing that sub-4 pretty close, and now I'm ready to do Muncie. But I don't even know if I can swing that, because that'd be 2 weeks after the baby's born.
I don't take anything you say about retirement seriously.
Yeah, I know.
We're,
I was
not doing, like you'll say, you always say, I'm never doing an Ironman again.
Yeah, I may never do an Ironman again. I'm not really.
Yeah, I know, but you're going to. Maybe not, though.
Yeah, but yeah, it's interesting, because I was fully prepared to just take on marathon training after this race, but now I'm like looking at the race calendar. The challenge is there's just not a lot. Obviously, in North America, there's not a ton of opportunities, and I have to be mindful of what a weekend away would be like with my wife having a newborn and a toddler running around. So we'll see what happens.
Yes, that's it's a lot. The second kid is there's a change that happens there.
Oh yeah.
It's tough. But you will certainly get through it, I think. And you better, I don't know. So there, I'm thinking about, so the goal is to go sub-4, right?
Yeah.
And then you can retire.
So probably. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just trying to think of the best races to pull that off. I mean, Clash is certainly a good one to do that, but then you have, yeah, like you said, Muncie, Augusta could help with the couple minutes that you get in the swim. But yeah, it's important to be strategic, I suppose. You missed Oregon. Oregon would have been a good one.
that would have been pretty wild. Yeah. I do want to have an honest swim, but
right,
you know, that's why Muncie is kind of appealing. Daytona, I know in the past the bike was short, but I know they've changed the route, so that could be. That could be an opportunity as well. So we will see, you know,
we'll have a few athletes sneaking under 4 there, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, this is the beauty of coaching and in athletics. Everyone has different responsibilities and, you know, trying to manage goals and expectations with life. If you're, you know, an age grouper, and then obviously as people make it to the pro level, you know, you can probably find a way to go all in and maximize your performance, and that's always pretty special.
Oh yeah, it's always a balancing act, and it's a puzzle. I mean, there's very little balance to it. I think that there are sort of seasons or periods where you can be really dialed in, and it's like, you know, I know Marshall, when he spoke at our camp a couple of years ago, he talked about the three-legged stool, and I think he's talked about, you know, training, family, work, and how, you know, it's okay for one of those to be longer or shorter at different times, so long as you could still sit on the stool. But the moment one of them is too short or too long, that could throw off the balance to the point where you can't sit on it. So
yeah,
that's the secret, figuring out the three-legged stool.
Yeah.
But cool. Well, good chatting. I think that covers everything. And if anybody wants to get in touch with us, feel free to submit a form on the website, workingtriathlete.com, or email us at info@workingtriathlete.com.
All right. Thanks for tuning in. And I'll see you in 2 weeks, Conrad.
Sounds good. See ya.